The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast, our weekly dive into the worlds of media, marketing and commerce. I'm Grace Dillon, editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted this week to be joined by COO of Total Media, Celine Saturnino. How are you, Celine?
I'm really well, thank you. Thanks for having me. Really excited to be here.
It's great to have you, and for our first in-person recording of the year, it's wonderful to have you. And I'm also delighted to be joined by co-host and sound guy, Lindsay Rowntree. How are you, Lindsay?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm a bit nervous about being sound guy, as you just said, first in person for a while, and trying to do the multitasking thing might not go well. And genuine actual sound guy might be very angry with me, but we shall see.
I should also mention Lindsay is COO of ExchangeWire.
Yes, it's a COO crew today.
It is, yes.
On the podcast, yeah.
Battle of the COOs.
Don't say that.
Well, hopefully not a battle. It'll just be a nice little chat, you know.
Of course. So we'll get started, as we always do, with our discussion of the three news stories of the week, starting with consumers could be receiving more digital ads that are relevant to their interests. That's according to Civic Science, who found that 41% of US adults think that the majority of digital advertisements are at least somewhat connected to their interests, a 6% increase from March last year and an 11% jump from March 2021. The number of people clicking on ads that they consider applicable to them also saw double-digit growth, rising from 43% in March 2022 to 56% in January 2023. The survey found that Gen Z and so-called young millennials, so those under the age of 35, are more likely to deem ads highly relevant than their older counterparts, with only 3% of adults over the age of 35 doing so. Furthermore, consumers who use social media were more than twice as likely to describe the digital ads they see as relevant. TikTok proved to be the platform with the most relevant ads, although the percentage of users who called the ads they see there as highly relevant has declined by 3%. Okay, so I suppose my initial question with this one, and I'll come to you first, Celine, is are you in any way surprised by these findings, especially kind of considering the impact of ATT in collecting, you know, user data and using those for targeted ads? Do you think it's surprising in that respect that, you know, more are calling the ads they see more relevant to them?
I think for us and the industry as a whole, it's probably a huge relief, to be honest. We've spent a huge amount of investment across the entire digital ecosystem into how we make advertising more relevant. If you think about the advancements in technology, today we're seeing on the supply side a big change in the product they can offer to market and how defined they can be around audiences. And on the buy side, working with DMP, CDP technologies, we're able to really understand a lot more about the customer and use that to fuel the way that we both target and optimize advertising. So from a targeting point of view, I'd say it's big tick. You know, the technology is obviously working. We, within our business, spend quite a lot of time also looking at understanding creative influence and creative optimization. And we have things like biometric technology, I think, which is super exciting for us and our brands, looking at emotional responsiveness to advertising and how we can pre-optimize campaigns to really get the maximum reaction in flight. So those sorts of advancements also give us, I think, a huge opportunity to keep on pushing the boundaries around relevance. Finally, I think from a measurement point of view, the whole industry seems to be talking about attention and really thinking about how do we grab people's attention, what value does it have. So people like Teads are talking about that a lot. So a lot of the ad verification partners also are helping us to understand how we grab attention and measure it more effectively. So if we add all of those things together, I think it's not surprising. It's actually a huge relief, and we hope to see it continue to grow. But if I compare it to some of the work that's been done by Kantar, for example, they release a lot of research into the market, which is comparing the role of digital to traditionally what we call offline channels. And there, actually, we see that offline does continue to outperform digital in terms of effectiveness, attention. And they have some very interesting stats around that. I'm looking at their most recent research. Cinema, for example, comes out as a channel which really gets the most effective reaction. And a lot of that is, I think, to do with mood states and thinking about your mood that you're in when you're at the cinema versus where you might be when you're on TikTok or looking at an e-commerce advert and so on. So there's still a lot for us to learn, I think, about understanding context, environment and effectiveness between channels.
What do you think, Lindsay? Are you surprised by any of these findings, or are they kind of in line with other findings you've come across?
I think I'm surprised. I mean, I guess they are in line generally with what we hear anecdotally and I guess other research that we see. But generally, I think I'm surprised that it, and I'm always surprised that it is such a low number. Like, the engagement is still so low. Like, 41% of US adults think the majority of digital advertisements are at least somewhat connected to their interests. It's not even highly relevant. It's just somewhat relevant to their interests. And it's even 50% is still too low. But that's the battle we're trying to achieve. I think as the report states, the reason that the increase is, despite being small, is significant is because thus far the growth has been so slow that seeing like a 7-8 percentage point increase is actually really, really fantastic and something for us to build on. And I guess if you look at the privacy changes that have happened over the past couple of years, seeing that kind of growth amidst all these privacy changes, like ATT, as you mentioned, I think that's potentially is showing that those kinds of approaches are positive and are actually helping, because the consumers do now have more of a choice than they've ever had before in terms of what they want to see. But you know, if I think personally as a consumer, what's relevant to me? I mean, Celine, you mentioned kind of the offline stuff is generally more engaging, and cinema, not surprised, love cinema advertising. And before we came, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, you talked about the ITV billboard, you know, those kinds of things. There is, I guess, cinema is slightly different in that it has a very captive audience, which we can't really say for most digital channels. But if you look at that versus, you know, just general online display, we are always going to be up against a challenge in trying to kind of increase engagement. The social media stats are interesting, I think, because again, despite the fact that in social media, influencers and advertisers have to display something as an ad, they really get context. For the most part, context is most understood in online advertising in the social media space, in my opinion. And you can be scrolling through TikTok, scrolling through Instagram, and you will look at an ad, but it will feel like other regular content you're looking at. So you'll probably be more engaged in that than you ever will be. If I'm seeing, like, I was trying to read an article just now, and I was bombarded by a Vueling takeover, and I was like, oh my God, it's making the screen slow, it's getting in the way. Vueling, what is they, like, great, I forgot Vueling existed. So actually, from that perspective, it worked. But they had an image of a city, I've got no idea what city it was, and I'm just like, well, I don't really get it's not in the spirit of advertising in terms of that hasn't, it's distracted me in the wrong way from what I'm trying to read. Contextually, it's irrelevant, because I think I was reading about TikTok, and also it slowed the page down. So there's still so many different barriers to overcome when it comes to digital ads. I guess this is positive, but I think that it's still, and the fact that clicks are up as well is positive too, but I feel like there's still just such a long way to go.
The only other thing I would add that we see as a huge shift in our sort of brand's focus is the amount of upfront work that's being done in really understanding audiences at quite an in-depth level within the brand before we even get to how we serve advertising, how we deliver it. So a lot of the work we've been doing with our brands is taking just the macro brand level, but looking at the specific products and saying, what's the audience of this product? How can we match your first party data with other data sets that we have available to us to understand their interests? And then even treating their audiences differently at a product level, which we do with someone like DeLonghi Kenwood, where they have very different products depending on their audiences. That, I think, is a huge shift in how we deliver advertising, and we'll, I think, make a big difference when they next run this research.
Interesting.
I mean, sticking with kind of the focus on first party data, obviously that's a move that's going to happen as, you know, we continue to move towards more privacy first solutions and cookie deprecation eventually happens. What are the kind of current challenges around that at the minute that's, you know, maybe preventing more firms from using it and refining advertising using it?
From a first party point of view?
Yeah.
It varies massively, I think, actually, depending on the brand. We have, if you look at the industry as a whole, you'll have some brands that are very data rich. They almost have so much data, they struggle to be able to manipulate it, organise it effectively. And there's huge, huge cost that's been borne by the brands or advertisers in organising that data, being able to invest in technology that helps them to organise and execute that data. So I think the barrier of sometimes investment of their time, the right resources, brand side, but also the cost of some of the technologies required to really deliver effectiveness is one challenge. And then we have categories that can be quite data scarce, is that the best word? So things like some of our FMCG brands that perhaps are not picking up the volume of activity, volume of sort of first party data. And then they're then relying on how can we pull together different data sets, either from our e-commerce partners or from other offline channels to try and bring together a more usable data set. So I think it's quite varied, but those are the macro challenges I see.
Yeah, I guess that's where first party data can't be the be all and end all. It can't be the focus, because you have companies like the FMCGs, the CPGs that don't have that first party data and having to go out and find other ways of being able to understand their audience and use different types of data from different sources effectively. And you know, it, I guess it then makes you look at kind of how can we make use of panel data? How can we make use of offline third party data? How can we make use of other sources of third party data we wouldn't normally consider? Because there's obviously so much talk about first party data and everything going cookie-less makes everyone go, oh, first party data. But actually, there needs to be, and you mentioned attention earlier, and attention plays a big role in kind of the open web and the non-first party data aspect, as well as kind of what we can do in the contextual aspect. I guess from your perspective, like how do you operate in helping your clients, like those that don't have access to first party data, kind of navigate what the rest of the ecosystem could look like for them?
Yeah, so I feel like I'm really lucky actually to have a team that focus on understanding things like looking at social data, and not just at a sort of a hygiene or a high level, but really looking into audience segmentation and saying, what are the personality profiles of these different audiences? What can we learn about their interests and who they follow, etc.? And we can combine that with things like panel data, etc., to really kind of deliver the best understanding that we can of their audience at quite a deep level without having to rely on CRM or other product level data.
My kind of last question to wrap up this story would be, one of the key questions kind of posed in the report itself was, you know, it's unclear whether, you know, ads are becoming more relevant themselves, you know, as creative, etc., or if it's a case of, you know, just better experimentation with digital formats. What do you, do you think that brands are, you know, experimenting more with digital formats and that is helping with the relevance aspect? What do you think?
I would say there's definitely more investment from a creative point of view. If you think about times of old, you might find that people were, you know, reformatting perhaps offline ads. Now people would take a much more kind of digital first approach to their creative advertising. There's a lot more lean in, I suppose, from some of the bigger tech providers talking about what really works on TikTok. So there's a lot to be learned, for example, from them, and people taking those learnings on board and delivering ads for entertainment. So I think there's definitely been a shift. I'd really love to see that shift go quite a lot further, because I think there's still a lot to do there. But I would say it's much more about the investment that brands have and really thinking digital first that's made a big difference.
I'll move us on to our second story of the week, which is that TikTok have reportedly offered to make the algorithms behind video recommendations available to US authorities. The proposal would see the social media giant opening the software that determines which videos US viewers see, how videos are moderated, and how they are deleted for monitoring by US tech companies. The move is a bid to avoid being banned from the country, with TikTok having reportedly promised to carry out a $1.5 billion reorganization to make their US operations more transparent. The short-form video app has already been barred from all mobile devices issued by the US House of Representatives due to security concerns, and Congress is currently reviewing proposed legislation for a nationwide ban. The Chinese government's reported plans to acquire shares in TikTok's parent company, ByteDance, in order to gain a say over how it operates, is expected to exacerbate US legislators' security concerns. So, Lindsay, I'll come to you first for this one. Do you think that it's inevitable that TikTok will have to give up some control over their US operations in order to stay in the country? And do you think that sharing their algorithms will actually, you know, have an impact on assuaging security concerns?
I mean, I don't know. And the thing is, yes and no. And we were joking about this before the podcast, like about half an hour before the podcast started, I was reading this and going, I haven't got an opinion on this. So I was asking the office and no one really had an opinion on it either. Then Celine, you arrived and you went, I haven't really got an opinion on this. And it's like, yeah, great. This is how big a news story this is. I mean, obviously everyone's going to be wondering if we're talking about Google, but I think that'll be a bigger story next week when even more will come out on that. But I think for TikTok, I mean, the thing about the data and opening up that algorithm, I think lends itself to the question, well, because in the article it mentioned, you know, companies like Oracle could then have access to their code to see how the algorithm's being used for US users. Well, then people just argue, well, aren't they doing what China might be doing via ByteDance anyway? So it helps the US, but it doesn't really help anything else in this. And China-US relations are so kind of on a knife edge at the moment anyway. The only real way for this to really work, I think, would be for TikTok to be divested from ByteDance and to be completely US owned. Otherwise, what's really being solved? Because yes, Oracle can access the code. Is it code that TikTok have given full access, or are they hiding other stuff that people can't see? You know, there's always going to be, even if the US can monitor the code, there's always going to be concerns around China's involvement as the owner, you know, ByteDance's involvement as the owner of TikTok, since, you know, especially with concerns around, you know, you mentioned yourself that Chinese plans to acquire a share of ByteDance to be able to have more control over it, as they've been doing with a lot of tech companies. That's always going to cause concerns. So I don't really know the answer to that. I think that a bigger concern around TikTok's algorithm more generally, whether the US has access to seeing how it works or not, is this kind of addictive nature and the targeting of kind of, you know, underage people and preteens. Like the UK Online Safety Bill will play a big role in this for across all social media platforms. And I saw a TikTok ad at Liverpool Street Station only the other day about the fact that what TikTok's age limits and age restrictions are. That's going to cause larger problems. And I think that they're the kind of things that we should be looking at with the algorithm, not whether the algorithm's being used to take data back to China, but how it's being used to target inappropriate content to underage consumers, personally.
Interesting. I mean, there were shouts, obviously, by... shouts is a very flippant way of putting it, but under the Trump administration to, as you said, should be done, divest TikTok's US operations. There was apparently a deal agreed for it to be acquired by Oracle. That was shelved under the Biden administration, but obviously it's now back on the table. Celine, what do you think of this story? I know we've just said there's no opinion, but have you had time to kind of, you know, think about it a bit more? And what do you think of, you know, Lindsay's perspective about, you know, how the algorithm is monitored and what should be done to the algorithm?
Sure. I think on the topic in general, obviously, it's a hugely sensitive political and macroeconomic issue. So commenting in too much depth on something like that is challenging at this point. If you, though, look at how big businesses have performed across those two different geos, it seems obvious that TikTok will need to find a way to work more amicably, if you want to say that, across the markets if it wants to survive, is my view. And I think they will end up at least having to provide some sort of level of information that allows them to continue to trade there. I think from in terms of actual content on TikTok, obviously they've done a huge amount of work to sort of up the age limit in terms of their user base. They're doing a lot of work in terms of how they make it more of a safe environment. I would say, however, as a mum in particular, that there's a long way to go. As a mum of a 9-year-old who would be constantly nagging for TikTok access, it definitely doesn't feel like there's enough yet to be done to stop children from accessing content that they shouldn't have access to. So of all the platforms, there's still a long way for them to go. So to make it safe. And that should be, I think, their priority.
When I Googled TikTok algorithm UK or something along those lines, TikTok algorithm like safety UK, all that came up were videos of how to remove the safety access, like the safety settings. And I was like, yeah, that's brilliant, because actually any 9-year-old can do the same thing and work out exactly how to remove the privacy settings to be able to access everything. And it's like, well, that's not really particularly helpful, is it?
Yeah. And particularly now, unfortunately, children are so technology technologically advanced, I can't even say it, that it scares me. So definitely agree. There's children can do more than we can, I think, a lot of the time.
Definitely.
Leaves it wide open.
Quite terrifying.
I mean, thinking more generally about TikTok as a platform, and, you know, it's obviously taken off with advertisers. I mean, do you think if this goes ahead and or even further, and TikTok are forced to divest their US operations, do you think that could have an impact on, you know, how advertisers use the platform or engage with the platform? Or do you think if it takes the route of, you know, better moderation and greater emphasis on safety, it's only going to be a plus for, you know, advertising on the platform?
The latter is definitely true in terms of if there's a, you know, a greater sense of protectionism within the platform, that'd be a plus. I think a lot of advertisers, I think, are still trying to work out the role of TikTok and how to navigate it. If you look at some of the more recent stats that have come out around certainly the younger demographics, almost using it as a replacement for Google search, and thinking about what are the implications of that from an advertiser point of view. Advertisers are still very much there of, is it an entertainment platform? Is it where I go to, where do people start their consumer journey with my brand there? How do I play in this space? And I think it feels like there's still an enormous amount of discovery work to be done in how to really play well in TikTok and how to maximize it, depending on your category and the audience you're trying to reach and their usage of the platform.
Yeah, I think I completely echo that. How to play well on TikTok is a really good way of describing it, because I, from where I sit, I feel like brands are still quite, not scared. Scared's maybe a bit of a harsh word, but they're reticent as to exactly how to approach the platform. They know it needs to be a completely different approach to what they're used to in other areas, but they don't really know how to get started. And if you look at some of the brands that have really embraced the platform, and when we had TikTok on the podcast, they gave examples of Dior, Microsoft, weirdly, and Costa Coffee. And looking at some of those examples, they're really clever, and they allow the influencers and the creators to really kind of take their brand messaging and run with it. There are many brands who just wouldn't let that happen. They wouldn't trust just allowing these random influencers to go away and sort of say, right, I'll do what I want with your brand, with your theme tune. And also the way that beyond the creator that you're working with, how the general users of TikTok would then take that and run with it and do other things with it, you know, like duetting, all that kind of stuff. I think brands can be quite scared of how that could make their brand look. But I think that I reckon there'll be a lot more of that this year. They'll understand. And when we had TikTok on the podcast at the back end of last year, but they mentioned themselves how big TikTok search is, and that people are using it to search for things. And I was thinking the same thing. And actually, a good example of that they use was so much content. If you search Google for something now, so much of the content on Google is SEO friendly within an inch of its life, that you're trying to find a recipe for something, you've got to dig through 1,000 words of content about why the recipe came about. When I was holidaying with my nonna in Italy, we then discovered this wonderful recipe that uses the freshest pasta, and they're like, where is the sodding recipe? That's all I care about. And that is what every page is like now. Whereas TikTok, you would search pasta recipe and you'd just get a 15 second video of how to do it, and you'd be like, right, boom, I can do that in no time at all. So I totally understand why, particularly I think the attention span of children is very limited, largely due to TikTok. And I remember we had a couple of guests on the podcast who have said the same thing with their children. Their attention span has gone out the window because of platforms like TikTok. But why are they going to go on Google search and trawl through all this content to find what they want when they can get it on TikTok immediately? So TikTok's created it and is fueling it and is going to cause problems for, I guess what the future of SEO potentially means on written content going forward.
It worries me when my daughter's on social media, because when ads come up, there's almost like a level of anger about how quickly that an ad can be moved past to get back to whatever she's watching at the time, which I'm trying to educate her. Importance of advertising.
You don't understand how valuable this is to you, yeah. I promise you.
Value exchange all the way. And on that note, I'll move us on to our final story of this week, which is the transparency of the UK's programmatic supply chain has improved, according to the second programmatic supply chain transparency study carried out by ISBA and PwC. The latest report has found that the so-called unknown delta, which was the term given to an unaccounted for proportion of advertising spend in the previous report, has fallen from 15% recorded in 2020 to just 3% in 2022. PwC's Sam Tomlinson, who led the report, said that high-end tech vendors have improved their data handling and sharing operations, which has accounted for a fall in unattributed spend. According to the study, the proportion of ad spend that goes to publishers has increased over the past 2 years, up from 51% in 2020 to 65% in 2022. Analysing 1.3 billion ad impressions across the websites of a raft of UK publishers, the 2022 study also found that the number of impressions that could be matched across the programmatic process increased dramatically, rising from just 12% in 2020 to 58% in 2022. So my first question really with this is, does it make you feel more positive about the transparency of the UK's programmatic supply chain? Selena, I'll ask you this one first.
Thank you. I think, to be honest, outside of this report, I feel generally that we have done an enormous amount of work within the digital ecosystem to deliver a greater level of transparency since the first report, which, to be honest, was a real wake-up call for the entire industry, with a lot of questions asked, a lot of under-the-hood work being done. So I think a lot has been done to improve the ecosystem. I think anything from ISBA always gives you a level of reassurance, to that kind of verification that, yes, all the work that's been done is really making a shift. From looking at our kind of business and what we see from our business, on the buy side, within the DSPs and technologies we're using, we have seen a greater level of transparency around the bid level in terms of what's the share of that that's attributed to fees, to the share that's going to publishers, in some cases looking at that sustainability impact and how you can affect that. So it definitely feels like from the buy side anyway, there's a greater level of transparency into what you're buying, the impact that will have, the share to publishers. So it's improved wildly. And I think thinking back to things like the introduction of as.txt has gone a long way. New suppliers coming aboard, which are all about just driving transparency. That's their key USP to market. So I think huge amounts been done. There's still more that could be done. There always could be. But I do feel confident in the investments we're making and how we can represent that back to our brands. There's a level of transparency that gives us some comfort, and that we look forward to seeing how that develops.
What about you, Lindsay? Does this new report give you more confidence in the supply chain's transparency?
Yeah, I mean, it all seems to be very positive on the face of it. I mean, we all remember how unpopular the first report was. Certainly many of the vendors were very, very upset about it and said, you know, it didn't really kind of, you didn't ask me for the right data. So how could it look transparent when all you asked me for? And actually they reference it in the kind of preamble of the report itself, saying previously we were not given log level data. We didn't have the capacity to be able to access log level data. The vendors were saying, well, we could have given it to you. And so there was a lot of kind of argument and frustration from the technology side for the last report. So there always will be when negative stuff comes out. So this is the problem. If it had come back nice and rosy, they wouldn't have complained about not supplying log level data. They'd have been like, oh yeah, aren't we wonderful? So it's going to be positive for the whole industry that we've seen such an improvement, certainly for the unknown delta, which I know caused a lot of concern. And again, a lot of the people on the technology side were saying, well, it's not unknown, it's this, this, and this, and you just can't track it correctly. But I think that was the issue, with the fact that it wasn't able to be tracked correctly. And the whole point of transparency in the supply chain is that we can see where the money goes. It's positive to see the publishers getting even more of the dollar than they were before, of the pound than they were before. If I think back to when I started in advertising, it was about 20% out of the pound or something, 20p out of the pound. So, you know, it's going up all the time, which is fantastic, because the advertisers want to see their money going to the right places. But we also have to acknowledge the role technology plays in allowing it to happen in the first place. I think that what's interesting to me as well is the fact that the walled gardens are called out as being a bit of a barrier to progress. They weren't really comfortably and openly sharing their data. So this doesn't really represent the full industry, which is something that's very important, especially because the walled gardens represent such a massive, massive chunk of the industry in terms of where ad spend goes. So we're not necessarily seeing the full picture, but it's a really positive picture. And I think, you know, the increases in impression matching, the reduction in the unknown delta are really, really positive, and everyone should be really pleased. I guess, Celine, kind of, you know, from perspective of where we sit, what's helpful for us to understand is, you mentioned that, you know, that things have improved since the report, and the report kind of really went under the hood the first time around in 2020. Have things actively changed as a result of that first report? Because also it came out around the time we all went into lockdown. you know, and a lot of advertisers were really looking under the hood themselves as to what, how their companies were operating. A lot of vendors had to do the same thing as well, and the publishers certainly were too. You know, did COVID cause this? Has as a drive to just increase cost efficiency generally caused this? Has things like trying to reduce carbon footprint even caused this kind of this increase in transparency as SPO and things like that have taken shape and allowed people to have more direct relationship and more collaboration? Or can we argue that the report has really kind of helped to affect this change?
Thank you. It's always a combination of factors. I think the report definitely felt like the wake-up moment, that kind of sharing of knowledge that people, if you're not kind of in the detail of digital delivery, might not have even known the questions to ask and known where to look. So I think that kind of awareness and education was a really important turning point for advertisers to be able to ask their agencies, their vendors, etc., the right questions. Now, behaviorally, I would say that the market expects transparency. Advertisers expect it from agencies. Agencies expect it from publishers and tech vendors. And there's almost a degree of, if you're not operating in that way, it would be unusual. So, I feel like there's a degree of confidence in just in the way that business is operating now, that was really, sort of pivoted from that report. I would say also that there's quite a big shift in accountability. Obviously, we're in the kind of macroeconomic climate that we're in. Advertising effectiveness is a huge focus. Really understanding for your £1, how much of that is delivering effectiveness and what you're seeing from things like econometric modelling, etc., is important and goes all the way down the value stream. And actually having all of your different parties kind of being rewarded on that basis makes a big difference. So much more outcome focused advertising, etc., which I think has shifted the dial on what's important.
Yeah, definitely. That makes a lot of sense.
I mean, Lindsay, you mentioned that the walled gardens weren't covered in the report. PwC did kind of state that that the report really covers what they would call premium operators.
Yes.
So marketplaces where there is greater transparency over ad spend. Does that kind of maybe give reason to kind of temper maybe our optimism about the report, do you think? Do you think that there's still, you know, reason to be concerned about, you know, not premium operators and as were called out in the report, like the long tail of ad tech? Do you think there's still reason for concern?
There's always reason for vigilance and kind of being aware of where money's going and you know, really vetting and auditing your partners anyway. So this is positive, but it doesn't show that everything's rosy. It does show there's still work to be done. So even if it is focusing more on the premium side of things, I think there's a shift to premium anyway. And there's certainly a shift to more collaboration, and with collaboration, transparency, and trying to the greater closer relationships between publishers and brands kind of ties in with the premium side of things anyway. And everyone's pushing for that, you know, with SPO, that's what's being pushed for too. So it doesn't really kind of talk about it doesn't really go into the detail about the long tail and the open web and you know, that huge, frankly, area where even more vigilance does have to be, there has to be even more caution applied. So that's where I guess a report would be very interesting, but that is a minefield. I'm not sure where PwC and ISBA would start on that. It's just such a minefield. It's such a vast space that is a bit of a, almost like a scary space. You know, some people think it's a giant black hole. I guess it's not, but you need to be really, really aware of where you're operating because there's lots of opportunity in there. The open web has huge opportunity. I'm not saying that premium doesn't exist in the open web, but it largely doesn't exist as much in the open web. And so that's where people need to kind of understand this is positive, but it doesn't show that everything's fantastic.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't think I've got anything that will further embellish your argument, but are we in programmatic 2 or 3 now, 2.0? But that kind of shift towards premium is definitely on the buy side what we're seeing. And I think it again is reflective of that kind of approach to effectiveness argument. And also agree that kind of open web is still a question mark for all of us, I think.
Interesting. Yes. one to delve into further.
Yeah, I'm sure it will come up at some other point. But we will leave our discussion of the news stories of the week there, and we'll move on to the second part of the podcast, where we talk a bit more to you, Celine, about what you're working on and what your areas of interest are at the minute. So I think just to start with, could you tell us a bit more about what's going on at Total Media and what you're focusing on at the minute?
Sure. So Total Media are a behavioural planning agency. So we're all about a really in-depth understanding of customers, how they behave, what influences behaviour. So we spend a lot of time in that area through our Behave consultancy. What's really exciting for me, I suppose, in seeing how our agency is developing, is really developing products and services that go take us into more of a business partner, business consultant. So we look at everything from things like business modelling, which has become a huge focus, particularly, again, I feel like I've talked about the economic environment a bit too much on this podcast, but particularly...
You can never talk about it too much. It is the backdrop of everything at the moment.
It's a relief. particularly in this environment, obviously advertisers have got a huge focus on having confidence in their investments. So we have a team of people really helping, supporting them and looking at business modelling and how their investments will grow and change as things adjust in the market. That's a big growth area for us and something I feel really comfortable that we're supporting our clients in that space. But we'll then take it into things like, I talked earlier about things like biometric testing and behavioural copy. So looking at emotional response to advertising, super exciting, love it when we do that. And then looking at how we can adapt. Content might be content for SEO or creative all around understanding behaviour. So some really exciting work in that place, as well as things like understanding price elasticity for clients, employee solutions. So our business is evolving rapidly. It's a really exciting time. We've just gone live with a new client. We're just onboarding a new client globally. So lots happening in terms of new brands coming to the family. And of course, my attention will always be a bit focused on what's new and exciting in media as well. So when I turn my attention that way, I'm looking at out of home, and I had the digitization out of home is super exciting. Something that makes me stand up and listen all the time. So whether that's, you know, we talked earlier about the ITV melting billboard or there's coughing billboards or things that you can do to use data, as we talked about earlier, to really deliver exciting and interesting executions for advertisers. And that kind of taking those new and exciting ideas to our clients is always really exciting to me. I think then finally my kind of running of the business, I only really have two jobs, which is to keep our
only
people
two.
Only two,
yeah. Oh god, just two. I've got about 25.
But my focus really is on how we make our business so sustainable and a happy place for the people that work there, and how we support our clients in sustainable growth. So all of the things that we're doing internally, whether that's from being a B Corp business, which we're really proud of, as we were the first independent agency to achieve B Corp status in 2021.
I didn't realise that. That's impressive. Excellent.
Thank you. Lots and lots of hard work went into that.
I'll bet, yeah.
But it is something we're very proud of, but it rules kind of how we run our business, both in terms of everything we do internally, but also how we contribute to the local environment, to partnering with charities and so on. So there's lots of really exciting work that we do in that space. That's very important to me. And as I say, from a client perspective, it's how can we really, really support you in everything from securing your investments to delivering innovation and everything in between.
What's your favorite, from a personal perspective, what's your favorite ad campaign? Like what things are kind of really like speaking to you at the moment?
Do you know, it always goes back to something that really stands out to you personally. And I've always been a big believer in something that's delivering an emotional response. And there was a campaign yonks and yonks and yonks ago, which was all about, it was from a coffee brand, and it was all about understanding your role in the boardroom versus your role at home, and sort of encouraging you to kind of have a flexible approach. And I think seeing the most recent example of that is probably BA with their new advertising, which is all about, you know, slow down, basically. Not taking your laptop and your phone on holiday with you. And I think they're doing a really good job of cutting through it. What's a really important time in terms of mental health and kind of having that real balance to work and home life.
I love those ads. If you haven't seen them, I've only seen them on the tube so far, so the out-of-home version. But basically, it's people's out-of-office replies, basically saying, I'm on holiday. I don't know about you, but I haven't got my laptop with me, so leave me alone, and I'll come back to you at the end of it. I'm off to have a cocktail. It's kind of, every single one is different messaging kind of around that, and it's really impactful. Like, they're the things that they definitely sparked my attention when I got them, saw them.
I haven't seen any of them, so I don't know if that's a sign that I don't deserve to see that.
I think that is a sign that you don't deserve holiday.
Yeah.
Ever.
I'd take it that way. Awesome. We're really getting underway into 2023. We're near the end of January already, which is insane.
Oh, that's terrifying.
It is. What is kind of your main, I guess, what's exciting you most about this new year, and what are you looking forward to going into further into 2023?
From a sort of business point of view, I think, you know, the most exciting thing for us is seeing the evolution of our product and how that evolves and helps us to support our brands. Even so early into the year, we're getting amazing feedback from our clients around how we're helping them to support them from really understanding their audiences and how that translates into media. We do some work with a company. It's all about bringing young people into advertising. We did a workshop with them. And actually, one of them asked one of our brands, what is it that behavioral planning really, really helps you with? And when my heart was fluttering and sort of wondering how they might respond. But their response was, it's really helped us to understand our audience and save money in advertising by delivering the most effective creative to the most effective audiences. And actually, in a world where clients need to have a plan A, B, C, and D, not knowing what might happen, what's around the corner, being able to support them through sort of some quite turbulent, challenging times is really important to us. So I'm excited to see how we can develop that and unfold that across the year. And from a media point of view, I'd really love to see where CTV goes this year. It seems to be
the year of CTV.
The year of CTV
forever.
But it's the hot topic, isn't it? And I'm really excited just to see how that unfolds and the new opportunities that might come from there and innovations that could come from CTV. Because I think we've seen huge innovation in out of home, and I think now's the time for CTV to kind of bring that new level of exciting, new, interesting opportunities for brands.
What about you personally?
Me personally?
A quiet life.
Yeah, quite a quiet life would be lovely. I think personally, look, I'm just moved into a new role not that long ago. So it's all about how can kind of get to the next challenge. And then outside of work, it's keeping my daughter off TikTok and being a
good
better
luck with
person.
That.
Fantastic. Well, that takes us to the end of the episode. So thank you so much, Celine, for joining us for the chat and telling us more about what you're working on. It was great to have you.
Thank you.
And thank you, Lindsay, for your multi-talent, as always, in being a great guest, great sound guy, and kind of co-host and CEO.
Don't thank me just yet on the sound guy thing. We'll the remains to be seen on that when the jury's out. But no, it's been a really lovely chat. Thank you for coming in, Celine. Great to have an in-person recording as well.
Yeah.
Love the vibe.
Definitely.
As the kids say. Did they say that? No.
That is one of my new objectives. I should have said that. My objective for this year is to be out more. <That's what>
That is not my objective.
We've made a great start here. Thank you everyone for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.